Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us on the Wise Women Media, the radio show. We have a great guest tonight. I wanted to just give a shout-out to some of our sponsors and tell you where you can find us online. Our website is wisewomenmedia.blogspot.com. Our sponsors are Daughters of Isis, Florida Nature Photos, Here Be Monsters, which gives us our space and time slot every week, Power New Media and Public Relations, Roundtree 7, Tarot and Stars, and the Hoodoo blog. Wisewomenmedia.blogspot.com also has all of our social networks listed. You can find us on Twitter. We have a Facebook group. We also have a Facebook page. There are also archived shows there going back over 2 years. So without further ado, oh, I did want to give a shout-out to the song, too. That was Frou Frou with Imogen Heap, and the song was Let Go. So let me give a shout-out to Rivera Sun, who's with us on the line. Hi, Rivera.
Hi there, Anita. Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's a great pleasure.
Well, people are just ranting and raving over your latest book, The Dandelion Insurrection, and it's definitely kind of, it's just been like a dandelion. It's just the dandelion seeds are going from place to place, and everybody's recommending the book, and people are reading it and buying it, and I think the message is so important. But what I think we should do now is kind of start at the beginning. And I had a few questions in regards to how you got from Maine to New Mexico. What made you want to go from the Great White North to a completely different landscape? And was this something that spurred on your creativity, or were you always writing before you happened? I don't know. That part of New Mexico seems to be very... it's like a vortex for creativity, especially going back Georgia O'Keeffe and people like that that made that same trek going from up north to down into the desert and just as sparse as possible landscape. So tell us a little bit about that, how you migrated there.
Well, there was a kind of an intermediary seven-year hop of I ended up in Santa Cruz, California for 7 years right after college. So I'd grown up in Maine, and as anyone who has ever been to Maine in the wintertime knows, there's a lot of reasons why a Maine farm girl would run away to California after college. It was warm there. There was fruit on the trees in the winter. And I was a dancer, and I ran a dance theater company in Santa Cruz in the Bay Area for 7 years, and at the end of those 7 years, I started writing solo plays that I would go around and perform all over the country from coast to coast. So at some point in my life, it was starting to be spent a lot of time on the road, which made me think I could live anywhere. So I got out a map with my partner, and we kind of did a little Ouija board trick of, you know, seeing where in the U.S. we might end up, and Taos started calling us. We kind of made a big leap out here. And Taos is actually where I started writing novels. Even though I had always written as a child, as soon as I got to college, there was this new thing called dancing, particularly modern dance, that I'd never done before. I didn't really know what it was, but it was so exciting that I spent 4 years studying it. And so my journey, when it brought me finally out to Taos a couple of years ago, kind of said, whoa, wait, let's get back to writing. And I wrote my first novel, which is called Steam Drills, Treadmills, and Shooting Stars, and it's about coal and climate change and mountaintop removal in West Virginia, which is kind of interesting right now because West Virginia is really suffering from a massive chemical contamination of their watershed. So it's
right.
A region that is very near and dear to my heart, and it just breaks my heart that yet another onslaught of abuse to their environment has occurred, and that's something we should all be aware of and following. So then after that first novel, The Dandelion Insurrection kind of followed creatively right on its heels, and I just sat down and wrote it. And The Dandelion Insurrection is really a story of nonviolent struggle to restore democracy in the United States, which is really at the root of a lot of our social problems, is that our democracy has been corrupted by big money interests, and we the people don't have much voice or say in our life decisions.
I've been working in the past with movements like Move to Amend and other movements that, you know, want to challenge the Citizens United corporatism that's taken over our country. So let's go into politics for a minute, if you care to. It's a situation that, you know, I think these movements are great, and I think that the awareness needs to be increased for a lot of these people that don't know exactly what's going on. They know something's wrong, but they don't know how to even go about and fix it. And that's where most people are at. But I'm of the firm belief now that I think we've passed some sort of a tipping point, and that probably was just within the past 4 to 8 years. And I really think that whatever we do at this point, if we're gonna fix it, it's gonna take a constitutional convention. The more that I think, if we're gonna continue on in the same political form, we're going to need to throw out what we've got and start over because it's not working. Mm. And that includes, you know, big money in politics and everything else. I love what Iceland has done. Have you done any research, any personal research, in what's been going on with Iceland and in regards to direct democracy?
Yeah, I co-host a weekly Occupy radio show, so I actually get a wonderful opportunity to dive into politics and social politics on a regular basis. And Iceland is fascinating to watch, the way that they kicked out their bankers instead of bailing them out, the way that they really, as a populace, grabbed hold of their corruption and said, we cannot live with this. And in a nonviolent way, which is very key for all of us to understand, they have really turned their country on its head and said, what is important to us and how can we meet that? I also follow Norway, which is a fascinating country. They have a long history of nonviolent struggle and people's movements, and they have used that to stay out of the European Union, to reassert people in their politics versus their 1%. Because they certainly had a 1% that was in control. And I think as we look around the world, there's just example after example of people using the strategies and tactics of nonviolent struggle to their benefit. And this is one reason that I wrote the Dandelion Insurrection, was because here in the U.S., we don't know a lot about how that works as a populace, as a whole. And I feel that...
Yeah, in spite of the... No. It was part of our history with, you know, Martin Luther King, and of course, in other countries as well, as we watched, you know, what Gandhi did in India. But still, I think the generations after Martin Luther King don't really have too clear-cut ideas on how the nonviolent struggle is really the most important, and it really is. It's a revolution just like any other. It's kind of like you, as an American, we kind of want to compare, you know, when we hear the word revolution, we think right away of the revolution in the 1700s, which gained our independence from England. But the revolutions don't have to be bloody. They can be peaceful. And for those of you that have not read Rivera's Son, The Dandelion Insurrection, I don't want to give too much away, but there's so much in that book about nonviolent struggle and doing the revolution in a loving way. And I got to ask you this, Rivera: are you the character of Zadie? Did you write that for yourself, or did you envision that character maybe in regards to someone you knew?
You know, someone said, I can't decide. Are you Charlie or are you Zadie? I mean, you love to write. You're also very flamboyant. Which one are you? And I said, I put a little bit of myself into every single character. And if you know me really well, you can see where I overlap with them. And then this person went out and started reading the book again to find out where I am in every single character. But I also put in a lot of elements of people that I know into the characters and mix them up. So some of the characters are tributes to actual people walking on this earth right now.
So when you were back, I mean, I just wanted to let you know, my family's from Quebec originally. My grandparents were from Quebec on my mother's side. And, you know, so I'm familiar with, you know, kind of like the overlap on the border areas, you know, with the French and the American, and the language, too. So, I was loving the very beginning of the book where you interplayed that quite a bit with the characters. And then my father's family came from Ontario. So I all four of my grandparents were Canadian. But I find it kind of interesting, you know, when you were discussing how they were flipping from English to French, and I thought, oh, my goodness, I had that right in my own household.
I feel so lucky to have grown up in the St. John Valley, which borders on Canada and where the Dandelion Insurrection begins, and to have come to a place in my life where I've traveled enough to understand what a culturally unique and amazing experience that was. Now that I'm in New Mexico, which is celebrated for its cultural diversity, it really gives me a very strong perspective on what I just considered normal growing up, even though I'm not French Acadian by blood. I did live there for 7 years as a teenager, and that was an amazing experience.
Yeah, and that area is pretty remote, too. For those of you that have never been up that way, it's about as remote can get in the United States. Pretty far away from everything. But I definitely love Quebec. It's one of my favorite places on earth, and I haven't explored Maine, and I'd really, you know, like to at some point. But I like the way you kind of made it alive with those characters. Were any of those characters your family members?
not the French Canadian, but Valier, the old man, was actually based on the man that we bought our farm from when my family moved there, Valier Dumé, who was a beautiful 80-year-old man who could outpick us no matter what we were picking, raspberries, potatoes, green beans. He just was a very hard worker and an amazingly wise old soul. So I did pay a tribute to him in the book. And that's really what the Dandelion Insurrection tries to do, is to celebrate that beauty of humanity in each of us and to know that it's one of our saving graces, that as our politics becomes crazier and crazier, one of the things they try to do is to dehumanize us and to get us to look at each other without seeing the beauty of our humanity. First, they try to get us to stop seeing each other as humans and to separate and divide us. But then more importantly, they try to make us forget that it's a beautiful thing to be a human being, and it's a beautiful thing to be alive on this planet. They try to get us to forget that beauty because that's what we struggle for. That's what makes it all worthwhile. So when I write about politics or nonviolent struggle, I always try to remind us constantly of what beautiful people we really are and how many beautiful people surround us. Because it's hard to see sometimes. Sometimes that beauty is hiding. But we need to remember it now more than ever.
And everybody has something to offer. Everybody has a gift or gifts to give. And when we're divided, most of the times we're not going to find out what those things are in the other person and be able to exchange those or overlap those or help one another with those gifts. So division is a big thing, and I see that happening in a lot of communities, whether it surrounds a workplace or a school or wherever. It's the powers that be want to divide all that up. In the Dandelion Insurrection, you spoke, of course, about revolution, and it was a love revolution. What is your take on programs that they seem to be airing quite a bit on television, some of them are pretty scary and a lot of them are violent, but the one I'm thinking of in particular is Revolution, and that's been constantly running probably for the past year on NBC. Have you had an opportunity to watch anything like that? And what is your take on it? Because what those shows reflect is that revolution is happening, or is going to happen, is inevitable. And I think they're putting this into the psyche of people. They don't call it programming for nothing. But it's almost like this is what's to be expected, this violent behavior. What's your take on that?
Yeah, wow, I'm glad you asked that. I don't have a television. I have never owned a television. It is poison for the mind, and I really feel that if people want to do something really proactive on behalf of all humanity, get rid of your television and go and get your friends to do something with you instead of watching TV in the evening. There's a lot that's happening in alternative media. None of that is on television. And like you said, the programming is very specifically programmed. The convincing of the populace that they must take up arms to have a revolution. I hate to do conspiracy theories, but I do think that this is a message that is being propagated by our, I don't know if it's consciously being done by our government or by corporate interests or who's doing it, but the truth is that the United States military is the strongest military might in the world, and by choosing weapons of violence, we, the people, have chosen what they are strongest at. That is foolish. Even a military tactician would tell us that is lunacy to try to do that. Fortunately, we do have other methods, and you will never see those methods on television, not once, because they are actually quite dangerous and effective at toppling tyranny from power. If people would like to find out more about that, I do recommend that they look into the work of the Albert Einstein Institution, which has been involved in toppling dictators around the world. I also recommend learning the story of Gandhi, not just his spiritual journey, but also his strength as a strategian, because nonviolent struggle works very effectively when wielded strategically. And if they want to form a small group to study this, I do run a network called the Love in Action Network, which helps you connect to these readings and form small groups in your community to talk about the problems that you perceive in our world and what you can do about them using effective nonviolent strategy.
Now, let's take it back to that was all really good, and I definitely want to do that. But let's take it back to the Earthship. Your bio says that you live in an Earthship in near Taos, New Mexico. And somebody today asked me what an Earthship was, and I told them, and I wasn't sure whether they understood it. And then I thought, well, maybe I don't even understand it. So why don't you tell our listeners exactly what an Earthship is and why you live there?
I live here because it was for rent on Craigslist. But
well, that's
the reason that I was so excited to find it there. Is an Earthship is a style of architecture that is built into the earth on the north, the west, and the east sides. And then the south face of it is almost all entirely windows. And it has an overhang that shades the indoor space in the summer when the sun climbs in the sky. And then in the winter when the sun drops in the sky with the tilt of the earth's axis, the sunlight reaches all the way in the house to the back wall of the house, meaning that we live at 7,000 feet here in Taos. There is snow on the ground. It gets down to negative 10, which is cold enough to be uncomfortable, and we don't have to heat our house.
Wow, that's amazing. So it's dug into the earth. Okay.
We also have gray water systems, and we have indoor growing space, so we can grow greens all through the winter. And some of the Earthships are completely off-grid and use solar power and rainwater catchment. We are connected to a well and the grid. I have high-speed internet here. It's kind of like a very nice, cushy alternative lifestyle, I'll have to admit.
Yeah, because if you were totally off the grid, you wouldn't be able to be online. But for your work, you really need to be online. So, you can't write really without a computer. You can't do research without a computer. I mean, it could be done, but if you're out into the woods, I'm sure your library is pretty far away too.
There's also
how far away are you from the Georgia O'Keeffe House in Abiquiu?
Oh, We're about an hour drive away from there. Yeah, it's not too far
away.
So
there's a lot of tourist stuff going on out there, but probably not near you.
Well, we live about 5 miles outside of Taos, so we're actually quite close to Taos. And Taos has amazing cultural events going on all the time. In fact, it takes a little bit of discipline on my part not to just go running into town to enjoy all of them. But I do try to stay home and get work done and do my writing and radio shows and things like that as well.
Now, how you do a radio show, what's the name of it? I listened to it the other night. It was great. But what's the name of the show so our listeners know, and how can they find it?
It's called Occupy Radio, and you can Google us. We are a Podomatic podcast program as part of the Occupy the Media Collective Podomatic group. And we broadcast on 5 to 6 Pacifica network stations. So if you are near a local Pacifica station, you can call up your station manager and see if our program is carried. And if not, please give us a little plug. We'd love to be on there. So there's a lot of ways to find us. You can also, you know, just Googling us is probably the easiest way.
And Occupy the Radio, of course, you know, the Occupy meme was just amazing. Occupy, we are the 99%. There's rumors of another Occupy rising. I've been hearing them probably for the past couple of weeks that it's going to be an Occupy pretty much nationwide. Nobody's given a date yet, but I'm sure it's coming. But what was your take when the Occupy movement began? And I can tell you myself, I was so excited. I just didn't know what to do. I live out in the woods, and I told my significant other, I said, I have to get to town. I said, I have to be there. I was just running around the house so exuberant and so glad that it was happening right here. So what was your take when it began? And how involved did you get at that particular time?
It was, like you said, it was extremely exciting. I mean, I think Occupy for many people in this country was the cork popping off of the bottle. And we all
right.
just sort of frothed up and got all excited and, you know, spent hours at the General Assemblies. And I was marginally involved in my Occupy group in Santa Cruz. Because I didn't really know what to make of it, you know. I actually wasn't very involved in activism before Occupy, like many people. And that's something I end up talking with people a lot, is that Occupy actually got a lot of people off of their couch, people who didn't really care before or cared but didn't engage before. And I was certainly one of those people who I cared about all these issues, but I wasn't engaged, you know. I was kind of living my nice little bubble life, and Occupy came along and popped it. And that's
yeah,
kind of...
it was amazing. It was an amazing time. And I think, you know, people kept talking about 2012, and of course this was late in 2011, and I'm going, is this the new stream of consciousness any of us thought was going to happen in 2012? You know, spiritually it seemed to be.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of talk
about...
Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, there is a lot of talk about 2014 being a year of action, and 2015 following on that trend. And I would say the way that becomes reality is if we all actually take an action somewhere along the line here in 2014. Now, that's what made Occupy so exciting, was that people actually did something. You know, they got together in public and said, let's model another form of democracy, and let's see if we can come together to take action. So as we look ahead to this year, there's many groups that are planning events, including the Green Party, including the Worldwide Wave of Action. Popular Resistance website covers a lot of the plans mm-hmm. and announcements and calls to actions that are coming out, and I think it's going to be a very exciting year.
Yeah, I've been... I'm connected with the Greens, of course. I've been a Green. I actually worked for the Kucinich campaign in 2008, and then I left the Democratic Party at the conclusion of that campaign when it was over. and became a Green, and then I ran for local office and I won. So I'm here in Florida. But the other group, of course, that I've worked with in the past is Transition. So we have a Transition Tampa that's been getting pretty active. And there's a lot of things happening in the Tampa area. One of the things that was kind of disheartening about the Occupy movement here was, in a lot of ways, it was co-opted by other groups. But there's still the core people that are left. So I don't think they want to take this kind of things that are brought on by the government laying down. They definitely want to do some actions, and a lot of them are kind of overlapping into other groups. So if there was a nationwide call to form again, they would. Popular Resistance, I agree, is a great website for information. And one of the people that's pretty active on it, Dennis Traynor, he's been doing a lot of videos, but he worked with me on the Kucinich campaign. So we kind of go back to like 2007, 2008. But I'm excited. I think if there's a nationwide call, I think General Assemblies, here we come, because I'll try to go to as many as I can. Now, Santa Cruz, where you were in California, is also kind of a vortex for creativity. Wouldn't you call it that? Seems like it's a hubbub of alternative and artists and writers. And I had a friend, and you may have known her. She lived there for many years, a writer by the name of Shekinah Mountain Water.
Oh, I know her very, very peripherally, more through, I think her son's name is Frey Faust, if I'm correct.
Yes, that's
who's fun. A dancer, and I studied in his technique a little bit and worked with an aerial dance company that really went deeply into the Axis syllabus, which is what he teaches. So, you know, that we find out more and more the world is much more connected than we think.
Yeah, I met Shekinah. She came here to Florida several times, and I met her in person. And then, of course, she passed a number of years ago. She calls it her Dance with Cancer. Her book is still an amazing, I would say, guidebook to anyone who follows the goddess path. And she didn't call it a Dianic path. She called it a woman spirit path, which I liked that terminology. But I still have her book. I recommend it highly to anybody who follows the goddess. And I miss her. I was on a lot of online groups with her, so we had a lot of interaction. And towards her last days, she mailed me a couple things. And I thought to myself, she's mailing these because she wants to make sure I get them, you know. And I thought that was precious. Of course, I didn't connect that until later. But, yeah, we're all connected. There's names of people that Shekinah knows, that you know, that I know. And I bet you if we sat down and had a real long conversation, we could figure out probably 6 or 7 or 10 more people that we know. It's interesting how the planet is not really that big.
No, I know. It's a huge population of human beings, the largest one we've ever had. But I do think that we're more able to see our interconnections than we have ever been on this planet for a very long time. We might have been able to do it in early tribal times on all the continents, but I think for a long time we've forgotten how to see in that way. And that when we start to look deeply into who we are, that we're not just these bodies and they're not just isolated to the outsides of our skin, that we are the air that we breathe in and we are the food that comes to us and the farmer that grew it and the whole chain that connects us to the entire web of humanity and the planet, it suddenly becomes very up close and personal. Nothing is external to your own lives. It's very deeply entwined. And I think that's something that moves me into action now, is that understanding. And it moves me into compassionate action. And that's one thing I really thought a lot about for the dandelion instruction is there's so many things that make me angry, you know, on pretty much a daily basis. I have to work with that. But if the practice is really seeing that we are all humans on this planet and we really need to approach our problems with a spirit of problem solving in a rapid fashion, because climate change is ticking a little countdown for us on how fast we will come to a different sort of world.
Right. I found it especially, it was a revelation when Edward Snowden made that comment, was it a week ago or 2 weeks ago? He made a comment about how the next generation coming up is not going to know anything about secrecy or privacy. It's not going to be a part of their lives. And I thought, wow, that's pretty profound to think about because, you know, as we've grown up, we before even cell phones, we've had a degree of safety just by having information, our own personal information, private. And that's no longer the case. And it's really scary to think about. Go ahead.
I was just thinking, I wrote an essay for Popular Resistance the other day in which I talked about the NSA has the phone records of my entire adult life.
Yeah.
That's how long they've been keeping the records on us all. And it really makes, in a way, there's no choice right now but to be courageous and to be truthful and honest. Because they're really, if they wanted to stop us from talking about these subjects and talking about how to empower people to take command of their own governments and lives, they could. It would be very easy for them to track them. And so I never try to hide in secrecy what I'm thinking about or what I'm writing about. I try to understand that I have an opportunity to really communicate, that if they want to know my thoughts, I can really get them to them. It's a unique moment in history, and if we approach it with fear, we lock down our possibilities. If we approach it with awareness, then we have an opportunity to really show courage in the face of adversity, which is really what the dandelion instruction is about. It's about courage that lies in all of us, that adversity can sometimes bring out if we allow it to.
And I've been reading more and more about that as I'm getting further in the book. I've had some problems. I'm actually reading the book electronically, and I had ordered it on my Kindle, and then I lost my Kindle. So I've been reading it on my phone now and have had problems with my phone all week, and I had hoped to finish it before we did the show tonight. But right now I'm on Chapter 17. So my question to you right now is, what's going to happen with this book? Is it going to be made into a movie or a play? Because it's almost like I can see it in my mind's eye as I'm reading what the characters are saying and what's happening in the story. I have such a vision of what's happening. It's almost like I can picture these characters and what they're doing. Do you have any hopes or aspirations to actually convert it into something visual?
You know, if anyone knows a great director and producer out there in the film industry, send them my way. I'm totally open to that happening. I don't know anyone personally. I'm a really darn good stage play writer. I have a lot of experience in that. But I haven't actually thought about converting this into a stage play at this point. It's an intriguing concept. I will have to think about it. I guess if listeners read the Dandelion Instruction and have an opinion on that, they should tell me. Let me know what they think.
That was the first thing I thought, especially I'm trying to remember. I think the visual thing that got me in the book so far, because like I said, I'm on Chapter 17, the very beginning, was the pots. And somebody, when they were doing Le Casserole in Montreal, Somebody did a very prolific short film of that. And to my knowledge, when I think back on it, I'll have to dig up the short film. I don't know if it's on YouTube. I kind of doubt it. But they did the short film. It was in black and white. There was sound. I don't recall them showing anybody talking, actually speaking. It was just the action of Le Casserole. And for anybody listening, this was when the people of Montreal took to the streets with their pots and just banged them and banged them. And, of course, there's a scene in the book, The Dandelion Insurrection, with the same thing. So because I had such a visual of that, that's why I thought, wait a minute, a play, a movie. Mm-hmm. I thought of that immediately.
That was one of amazing prophetic moments of writing. I can't even count how many times I had written something in the course of making this book, only to see it become real a month later. So I had written that into
that's
Dandelion Instruction.
Oh, you mean you wrote it before? You wrote that before?
Well, I wrote it, and then they did it in Turkey for the Gezi Park uprisings. At one point in their protests, they broke out the pots and pans, and they flicked the lights in the buildings. And I remember watching that video and being like, oh, my goodness, I just wrote this. Another prophetic moment was I had written that the United States no longer has a functional democracy due to corporate corruption of politics. And a few months later, President Jimmy Carter, former president, spoke, I think it was to Der Spiegel in Germany. I think it was some function he was at. You can Google this and find out. But he said, quote, America no longer has a functioning democracy at this time.
Right, I remember that.
I think people need to really grapple with that statement and really understand that if we don't have a functioning democracy, what does that mean we have by default? It's not a dysfunctional democracy. It is not a democracy. That's
well,
that
is
I
it a corporatocracy?
Corporatocracy?
Yeah, corporatocracy. Yeah, that's the only thing I could call it. It fits. It's definitely fascist. I mean, when you go over the four, and anybody can Google this to see it, the 14 points of defining fascism, and the United States fits all 14 of those points when you read them through. And I thought, wow, that's really scary. And I did that probably 5 or 6 years ago, and I said, we're in a fascist country. This has become a fascist corporatist state.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a rude awakening for me, let me tell you. And it made me work very harder at the activism that I was doing. But now, like I said, I don't know if we've passed some kind of tipping point, but I think working to remove corporatocracy at this point is probably not going to work, because as we, in the form that we're at now, if we want to improve on this form, we're going to have to throw out what we've got and start over. That's why I believe that it's possible we would need a constitutional convention. The direct democracy in Iceland is another idea. You know, I don't know if we could carry that off if we have too high of a population. And I'm sure other people have different ideas, but those are two that I've had. I've worked really hard at trying to just, at this point, do things locally. I don't know what I can do, you know, state or federal anymore. And as an elected person, well, next year I'm not going to be elected, so I'll be able to step back and do quite a lot more, I think. But what are your ideas on a constitutional convention?
You know, that's very interesting. I feel like I consider this question like a pebble in my hand, turning it over every single day. And with a lot of people, reform, sheer revolution, is what we have in our Constitution enough for who we are as a people today? Is there something better that we could come up with?
Yeah, that's a good question.
I think that's a good question for us all to ponder as we're looking at the problems that we face. You know, there's several sets of rights that are either awarded in our current legal structure that many of us don't agree with, corporate rights being the most obvious. And then there's other rights that aren't acknowledged at all in our Constitution, such as the right to a free and open Internet, uncensored, the right of natural systems to thrive in their setting. You know, we've made great strides from the beginning of our Constitution, which was very limited in its scope, to embracing...
Can you hear me okay? Because we're having a technical, maybe a sound difficulty. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you great now, yeah.
Okay, yeah, we were starting to get, I don't know what was happening there, but I'm going to put you on speaker again. Is that a little clearer?
Mm-hmm. You sound fine now.
Okay, good. I think I was losing the charge on the other phone. I don't know exactly what was happening, but I switched it, and it seemed to be okay. So I think you have a pretty good point there that it would be, what do we need as a people now, and what we got in the 1700s is probably not going to work for who we are now. So if we were throwing out the baby with the bathwater, as it were, the old Constitution, and gathering to build a new government, it probably wouldn't look a lot like the old one. I'm thinking that, you know.
Yeah, so. You know, that would be a very interesting conversation to have with people. There are many people in this country who firmly believe that a representational system is the best way to do it. There are a lot of other people who feel that a direct democratic system is the best way to do it. And personally, I'd be very excited to see a direct democracy take place. I think we've come a long way as human beings on this planet. And I think the other key thing about people's democracy or direct democracy is that, like all forms of government, they're only as good as the people involved in them. So when we're actually talking about revolution, the most important place that it happens is inside us. When we become
mm-hmm.
worthy of sharing this planet with each other, when we become capable of governing ourselves and our own lives and working with our own families and communities to respectfully listen and negotiate, then we'll find that our governmental systems might reflect some of those behaviors more than we currently see.
Mm-hmm. Right. And for those of you that are listening that do not understand exactly what direct democracy is, you can look up online what Iceland has done over the past couple of years. And also, from what I understand, and I wish I knew more, I keep reading about it, but there's so much more to learn. Direct democracy is represented by people in their country that are, and correct me if I'm wrong, Rivera, because I'm not sure, it's issues-based. So when your representation comes up to actually make a vote or propose something, they are the experts in that particular issue that they're working on. And there's no such thing as lobbyists. There's not money in politics. And the people have a say-so. So the representation is by the experts, and the people get to decide instead of the lobbyists or the corporations. So if I got that right...
Yeah, I think there are a couple different formats that direct democracy can take and have manifested around the world, but one of the most, the key or central definition involves the idea that the decision makers are the people. So, for instance, in the United States, we vote on our president, but we don't really vote on our president. The system of the Electoral College elects our president, unless this happens to be George Bush Jr., when he was actually appointed by the Supreme Court that stopped the Florida vote count. I always tell that story because that was my first presidential election, and it really explains a lot about why people my age are completely disillusioned with politics. That we have seen a total corrupt and obvious failure of democracy in our lifetime. So direct democracy, by contrast, would be one person, one vote, cast your vote, and the you elect the president. No intermediaries. Like all the bills that are in Congress, they could be put to the people. The people could decide on them. It takes tremendous faith and trust in each other and in our peoples. But I think that kind of respect for one another and respect for information and education are very valuable aspects to a democratic society. I think one of our major problems right now in our country is the total disinformation and misinformation that goes out through the corporatized media. That's a real failure
right.
of our culture.
Right. It's the who controls the information is who can pay for it. So if they have the money to pay for it, they can bend it into whatever they can bend the truth to whatever they perceive it to be or want it to be or want the masses to think that it is. So that's where we're at right now, and it's like that when we watch the news, when we look at advertising. Again, you know, I said it earlier, you know, that's why they call it programming on television, but it's not just in television. It's on radio. It's on billboards. Very slick marketing is everywhere we turn, basically. And I'm at the point now where I don't buy anything if I don't need it, and I definitely don't buy anything from China. So if I can't get it at a secondhand store, most of the times I won't get it. If it's something I need, of course, but I will not buy retail for things if I don't have to. So my latest purchase...
Supporting your local community members, your local businesses, especially in the realm of food, is a tremendous thing. You know, you're involved with the transition movement, which does a lot of wonderful work around transitioning our communities from fossil fuels and mega corporate global commerce to locally based systems. And, I mentioned early in the interview that I grew up on a farm. It was an organic farm up at the top of the state of Maine. And my family started a small family business to market our potatoes in a cooperative of 10 other farmers. And over the years, that grew into Crown of Maine Organic Cooperative, which distributes Maine-made produce and product all around the state. And this has become a real source of pride for people in the state of Maine that they can buy their local flavor, they can support their local growers. And I've witnessed a long-term effort towards local communities and local economies making a huge difference in a state that is not a rich state. It's not a wealthy state, but it is a very determined state, a state that has always had a strong sense of independence. And I like to share this story because it shows us what is possible in the small actions and decisions that we make every single day. And like you said, Anita, you know, you make these commitments to shop consciously, and that does make a difference. And then once you get accustomed to making those decisions, you don't even think twice about it. And so now you have all this time to think about, maybe I'll go down to that occupation, or when's the next big uprising going to happen?
Right. My life changed just, you know, like a year ago when I bought at a secondhand store a $5 bread machine maker. And I thought, oh, this is wonderful. I won't have to buy bread anymore at $2.99 a loaf. As a diabetic, I'm always looking for, like, low-carb bread or, you know, bread with no sugar, no high fructose corn syrup, all of that. So I haven't bought a loaf of bread since. So for $5, I got a bread machine maker that had been never used. It was from 1998, and I had the original operational recipes. And, you know, so that just that small little purchase changed one little aspect of my life. And I don't want to go back to the old where I was buying bread. That's just an example. Another thing I wanted to mention that kind of is what you were saying about farming. There's an incredible book that I wanted to tell people about called The Next American Revolution by Grace Lee Boggs, and a long-time activist in the struggle. And she's, I think at this point in time, she's 96 years old, and she's still living in the Detroit area. But she said the most revolutionary thing that you can do is plant something in the ground. I thought that was really interesting. She mentioned that in the book. So a really amazing American woman of wisdom. And I encourage everybody, along with getting the Dandelion Insurrection, after you read that, go get The Next American Revolution by Grace Lee Boggs.
Grace Lee Boggs,
incredible
living example of the Dandelion.
Say that again?
Grace Lee Boggs,
yep,
is a living example of the Dandelion Insurrection.
Exactly, exactly. And when you read that book, you'll know. The two of them are, there's so many things that she said that you put into examples in the Dandelion Insurrection. She was stating them as, you know, she was giving a history of the struggle, basically, in a good portion of that book, The Next American Revolution. But you put it into characters taking action. So they're very linked, those two books, in that regard. I wanted you to give us a little rundown as we go from the Dandelion Insurrection into some of your plays, and I want to make sure people know where to find Rivera Sun online. You can go to the Rising Sun Dance Theater, all one word, www.risingsundancetheater.com, and that has everything that Rivera is doing. Books, the plays, the little, there's a write-up here on the radio show you just did this past week with Catherine Power. But tell us a little bit about the character that's in your plays, Lala. And how did you come to create her?
Lala is a 10-year-old black girl in 1890s Kansas in an all-black town. And she came to me sort of in a vision when I was in Santa Cruz. I had done a lot of shows about my own life and my own perspective. And so when Lala came up as a story in my mind, I thought, well, let's try it out. And I started writing the story about when a Chinese man comes into the town and no one in the town has ever seen a Chinese man before. So we get to look at how people accept each other or become afraid of each other based on the color of their skin or their culture or economic pressures, all those things. So the first play deals with that, and then there's two others in the series about Lala. And the second one deals with when she's 14 and discovering her own spiritual journey, her own spiritual path, and when that comes into conflict with her elders in her society, how they find a way to discuss that and to accept differences of opinion, particularly religious opinion, which is an important theme in this country. The third play is an epic quest, a spiritual quest of 18-year-old Lala, who has at this point experienced some real hard knocks in life and goes out to find an end to her suffering. So it's an amazing series, and what makes it really amazing is that after performing for an hour and a half as a solo performer, I'll do all the characters, all the different ages and genders and ethnicities, just switching with my one self from one character to the next. I will then sit down on the stage and listen to the audience, listen to their questions and their comments, and hear what's on their mind about these issues. And for me, that's the most amazing part. I mean, the stories are incredible. They get standing ovations all the time, and people love them. They cry, they laugh. But for me, the most amazing thing is what happens in the people who are watching the plays. And as a artist, that is the joy, is when you know that you have affected someone for the rest of their life.
And it's almost to the point, I've seen plays like this, I've called them, you know, one-man shows or one-woman shows, where, another actor that I've watched do this is, and you probably know who he is, John Leguizamo, which is pretty awesome because he can even, you know, he can act and he can switch genders and do all kinds of crazy stuff. But what I like is it's almost to the point when you see acting like that where you're channeling each character. What do you think about that? Is that kind of what happens? That character just takes over and speaks through you and you allow it?
People
is
say
that,
that
how you
to
like
me
it?
All the time. Oh. That's a very frequent comment of, you must be channeling this, or are you channeling this? And for me as an actress, I know there's a lot of drilling and there's a lot of practice that goes into that. What it feels to me from the inside is allowing the character or the spirit to walk in you for a while. That the actor or the actress's job is to quiet themselves, to strip away all the parts of our own characters that could get in the way of another character coming through, and to step into service of the story. And, yeah, at times it can feel like something else is taking charge, and you're still hitting your cue to be on the right spot for when the light shifts. But but the character is very alive inside you, and you can feel it in your own little frame and torso. It's a really amazing experience.
I saw a show, a one-woman show, which was pretty incredible. I had a friend who was going to Eckerd College, and she was studying Florida history. And there was a woman that came through, and I cannot remember her name, but she channeled, and that's what I called it, she channeled for her presentation, Marjorie Kennan Rawlings. And she had the accent down, and it was so hot. I was drinking my tea, and she was just perfect. And I thought, oh my God, because it was almost like watching her was almost like a spiritual experience, just seeing how she became the character. So, for those of you that want to know what Rivera Sun does with her acting and see this character, when you go to her website, there's videos there, so you will be able to watch a couple of minutes at a time of her actually acting, becoming Lala. And very, very interesting to watch. And if there are any media inquiries, you can do that through the site as well. So if you want her to appear at events that you're having in your local area, you can let her know right through the website. And again, that's risingsundancetheater.com. So that is interesting. Lala is definitely an incredible character. And that was what I liked so much about The Dandelion Insurrection. And I have not read the previous book that you did, Steam Drills, Treadmills, and Shooting Stars, but that's next on my list. But that was one of the things I loved about The Dandelion Insurrection, was the characters have come to life.
I was going to say that the theater training has allowed me to find out how to bring characters to life. Those are my exact words.
Now, when I saw the video of you discussing the book, you had a lot of papers with a lot of notes. So it looked like there were notes in the margins and things crossed out. So tell me, what is your process for writing? Are you actually sitting at a typewriter, or are you writing everything out longhand and then going over it again?
Oh, that's right. In the video, it does show early draft work on the book, which is beautiful to think back on. at this point. I write my first drafts by hand in number two pencil. It slows my hands down enough to let my mind actually choose the words carefully. And as you probably see in the dandelion instruction and also in steam drills, I really love words. I love poetry. I love metaphor. I love using precision of language and really rich description. And writing in pencil to begin with lets my mind have the space to get quiet, to hear those words coming through, to think about the aspects of the scene that might come alive with exactly the right word. So after I've written it in pencil, I will then type it into the computer, and then begins my phase of wrestling matches where I, you know, use the beauty of the word processor to haul it from one end of the book to another end of the book. And I'll print out drafts and make lots and lots of notes. And about this point in the process, I start, like, pulling my hair out and saying, how can anyone ever think that I channel this stuff? Because there's certainly a lot of work that goes into it.
But it becomes, I don't know about you, but when I have a piece that I've written, it's almost like a child. It's almost like I feel like I've given birth to it. So, and I want it to succeed. I think that's the funny part. It's all go, I want this to succeed. I want people to read it. I want it to be famous. You know?
Uh-huh.
So, so I'm thinking, okay, what's the difference between that and a 16-year-old or something?
Will you please grow up and become the president of the United States?
Yeah, right. It becomes so it really is a child for all intensive purposes. But that's that was one of the things I noticed right away with the book as soon as I cracked it open was, you know, you had this in the very beginning, the setting where they're all meeting secretly, and you could tell the difference in the characters by what they were speaking and saying, and they were having a conversation. And I thought that's another point in the book, too, where I thought I'm seeing a play here. I'm actually seeing a specific tangible place where they're interacting.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, that would be an easy scene to do. So as I've been reading through, I've been saying, okay, how would this scene be done and how would this scene be done? And I'm not a playwright, but I've always been interested in screenwriting, but definitely have not written plays. So it's funny how that's come to life for me as I've read through the book so far. So I can hardly
I feel
wait
like
to get
that's
to the
a great
end.
Compliment.
And then... Oh yeah, and that's what a book is supposed to do, of course. So we're coming to the end of the show, and I just wanted to give you maybe some time for some closing comments and where you'd like to be in 10 years, and what you'd like to accomplish maybe within the short term, and just I'll turn it over to you and you can fill us in.
Wow, 10 years. In 10 years, you know, the first thing that stirs in my heart is not actually a prayer or a wish for my own career or success, but that we are all looking out at a world that we have learned to live sustainably in and are making tremendous strides and efforts towards shifting our culture to that sustainable world. That really struck me very strongly that that is the most important thing for our society and people in our country especially to focus on and look at doing right now. And as an artist, I will do my best in these years to come to be a part of that change, to be inspirational in that change, to be writing about the courage that it takes to make those changes, to be welcoming your stories from all around this country, to be celebrating the golden soul that lies within each and every single one of us, and to be really thanking each of us in gratitude for the tremendous efforts and sacrifices even that it has taken us in our culture to achieve a more sustainable lifestyle on this planet. And beyond that, who knows? Who knows what these days will bring, except that I welcome meeting each and every one of us as we do it.
Yeah, the possibilities are endless. And I read books like yours and other books that were, you know, written straight from people's visions, like The Fifth Sacred Thing by Starhawk, for instance. You know, I read these things, and there's such a clear vision for the future and how it could work. And how are we going to get everybody on that same page is the challenge, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's a tough one. But A Fifth Sacred Thing is another highly recommended book, which I think in some respects it does overlap some of the things in your book, even though Starhawk wrote that way back in 1993. And there's a lot of current parallels with that book, too. So, but I'd love to have you back on again to see what you're doing. And now, how can people get in touch with you? Through the website that I mentioned, therisingsundancetheater.com?
Yeah, they can also find me on Facebook as Rivera Sun or on Twitter at Rivera Sun Author. And they can go to my blog, which is risingsundancetheater.com/WP blog. And that's a mouthful, but you'll find it if you Google it. And they can also, if they're interested, they can follow my articles. I do an Occupy Radio Show companion article on popular resistance each week that comes out on Thursday or Friday. And then on Sundays, something very special happens, which is that dandelionsalad.com publishes an essay of The Man from the North. And The Man from the North is a fictional character in the Dandelion Instruction who is a writer that ignites the revolution that happens. So every week I write a new essay from The Man from the North, and people love these. They're just getting so excited about them. So it's a real joy, and I encourage people to track them down.
Yeah, The Dandelion Salad is a news story. Actually, that Lo Daniels, who puts that together, I actually met her during the Kucinich campaign, not in person, but we were connected online. And we've stayed in touch with each other over the years, but for really concise news stories, that blog is highly recommended, The Dandelion Salad. So if you Google that, you'll find that. And Lo Daniels is great. She started putting that together several years ago and has been pretty consistent with it ever since. It's really become a good place to go for news that you're not going to find anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to just let you know that we'll have you back on again to maybe in 6 months, 9 months, a year, and you can tell us what you're up to. And would love to have you come down here to Florida. So I'll talk to a few people and see if we can make that happen.
Thank you.
Yeah, a book signing or, you know, an appearance somewhere. So we'll figure that out. I'll be working with other people with our local person here that's with the Green Shadow Cabinet, because he and I discussed this, actually, having you come down. So we'll figure all that out and make that another phone call, perhaps.
Or wonderful. Well, it's been a great pleasure and delight to do the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for doing this show, and we'll close with a song by Laura Veers that I think you're going to like, Rivera. It's called The Sun Song. And everyone have a great night. You can find us at wisewomenmedia.blogspot.com. Don't forget to hit the GoFundMe link, because this is independent media and we take no corporate sponsorship. And we'll see you next week with another show. So on to Laura Veers, The Sun Song. Thank you, everyone who's listening out there.
Been several months. We got the sun to thank. We got the sun.